we mess up. And Lord, I know for me, that is often every minute of every day. God, we can run to you again and again and again and again and again. There is no ending. There is no limit to your grace. You love your children with a love that is undeniable. It's everlasting. It's relentless. And God, we thank you for that great love. And Lord, I want to pray for those in here who are maybe hurting or experiencing loss or experiencing grief. Lord, that they would run to you and receive the comfort and the refuge that you offer. God, you are so good. Please be with us as we open your word together. It's in Jesus' beautiful name we pray. Amen. All right. We're going to be in 1 Samuel 21, if you want to turn there. So last week, we ended things with David and Jonathan parting ways. Really sad moment. King Saul has decided that David is a threat to his kingdom and to his legacy, so he wants him dead. And at first, he tried to get David killed, but now Saul wants to kill David with his own hands. So David runs. That's all he knows to do. And where he runs to makes a lot of sense. He goes to Nob. Nob is where the holy tabernacle is. And we know the tabernacle was kept and maintained by Levites, who were the priests of Israel. So David chose to run to a city filled with priests, to the sacred tent where God's presence dwelt. That's a good idea. That's a really good idea. That's a good idea for us today, just like the song taught us. If we're scared or we're confused or if life's beating us down, it is a really good idea to run to Jesus and to seek out the fellowship of his saints. Jesus has made all of us a priesthood of believers who are all supposed to minister and care for one another. It's a really beautiful thing. And one of the best indicators of our trust in Jesus will always be, where do we go when things get sideways? Do we run to Jesus or do we run away from Jesus to something else? And here, David chooses to run to his God. In verse 1 of chapter 21 tells us what happens when he gets there. So let's read that. It says, "Then David came to Nob, to Ahimelech, the priest. And Ahimelech came to meet David, trembling, and said to him, 'Why are you alone and no one with you?' And David said to Ahimelech, the priest, 'The king has charged me with a matter and said to me, let no one know anything of the matter about which I send you and with which I have charged you. I have made an appointment with the young men for such and such a place.'" So obviously none of that's true, okay? And I've read where folks have tried to justify David's deceit by saying, well, he needed to lie to protect himself. Or he was just trying to protect Ahimelech by not involving him any more than he had to. And all of that may be true, but what I don't understand is this need to justify David's dishonesty. Like somehow David's more than he is. It's like we said about Saul last week, the people in the Bible are just people. David was a man after God's own heart, but he was still just a man, right? And I think when we try to rationalize lies and justify sinful behavior, we're not doing the good news of Jesus any favors. We might actually be casting doubt on what Jesus wants everyone to understand. And in this case, it's that dangerous truth is far better than convenient lies. David had no issues that we're aware of with facing a monster like Goliath because he trusted God completely at that moment. Well, here at Nob, he's scared. He's anxious. And who can blame him, right? I mean, the king of Israel wants him dead. For all David knows, Saul's already dispatched teams of killers to hunt him down. You know, if he wasn't worried about that, we'd probably be worried about him, right? Because again, he's human. Now, he's a hero for sure, but David is a flawed hero. and with heightened anxiety, and he's in full fight or flight mode, he chooses not to tell Ahimelech the truth about why he's there. And I wonder if David realizes that trying to explain himself to Ahimelech may not be the best idea. Because in their conversation, all of a sudden he stops talking about why he's there and he asks Ahimelech for some food. He just does a left turn. Look at verse 3. It says, now then, he's asking Ahimelech, now then, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever's here. And the priest answered David, I have no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread, if the young men have kept themselves from women. And David answered the priest, truly, women have been kept from us as always when I go on an expedition. The vessels of the young men are holy, even when it is an ordinary journey. How much more today will their vessels be holy? See, David really wants that bread. In verse 6 says, so the priest gave him the holy bread, for there was no bread there but the bread of the presence, which is removed from before the Lord to be replaced by hot bread on the day it's taken away. So for those who may not know, the bread of the presence, it's also called the showbread. It was baked in 12 loaves, one for each of Israel's 12 tribes. And it was placed on a golden table in 2 stacks, 6 in each stack. 6 times 2 is 12, right? Okay. And then the 2 stacks were sprinkled with frankincense. Now, I got a picture of the tabernacle. There it is. Okay. Oh, no. Technology. Gotta love it. Okay. So this is the entrance to the tabernacle. It faces east. And when you walk in the tabernacle, see this right here, this is Chuck. He's guarding the entrance to the tabernacle. And this is, when you walk into the tabernacle, this is the showbread right here. It's on your right when you walk in directly across from the lampstand. And the reason it's called the bread of the presence is because it sits near the presence of God, which dwelt behind this curtain in the Holy of Holies in the Ark of the Covenant. So the priest would replace that bread every Sabbath. It would sit there for a week close to the presence of God. And an interesting side note about this particular story is that Jesus used this story in an argument that he had with some Pharisees. We can read about it in Matthew 12. Luke and Mark, they also record it. But in Matthew's version, in Matthew 12, starting in verse 1, it says, at that time Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry, and they began to pluck heads of grain and to eat. But when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, look, your disciples are doing what's not lawful to do on the Sabbath. And he said to them, have you not read what David did when he was hungry and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God and ate the bread of the presence, which it was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only for the priests. So the point Jesus was making was that God never intended for laws and rituals to be more important than people. Ahimelech understood that. So he gave David the bread. He also gave David something else. He gave him a sword. Now this is Goliath's sword, y'all. It must have been placed in the tabernacle for safekeeping. And I guess the way Ahimelech saw things, that sword belonged to David anyway. David needed a weapon. So he was given that sword. Now, verse 7 almost seems out of place. It reads, now a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord. His name was Doeg, the Edomite, the chief of Saul's herdsmen. Now, verse 7 is going to be very important a little later. But right now, it's just kind of there. And you know, something that I've learned over the years is that the biblical writers do things like that. You know, they'll stick in a quirky detail here or an obscure reference there that doesn't seem to fit with the story you're reading. And I think the reason they do that is because they intend for the readers to keep reading, you know, to read large chunks of the story, if not the entire story at one time, and then to think about the story and to meditate on what they've read. Tim Mackey refers to the Old Testament as meditation literature, meaning it's meant to be pondered and chewed on and compared with other ancient writings, and that's somewhat foreign for us modern folks. We like everything to be, you know, linear. We want a clear beginning, a clear middle, and a clear ending. It's just how we're taught to approach everything that we read. But these ancient writers of the ancient world, they didn't write that way. So for us to better kind of make sense of things, we really need to adjust the way we approach these ancient writings like the Bible. But back to David. It's like I said earlier, David going to Nob makes perfect sense. Now, where David goes after he leaves Nob does not make a lot of sense. He goes to Gath. Now, Gath is where Goliath was from. And David's going there with Goliath's sword. So what's he up to? Well, verse 10 almost makes it sound like a social visit or something. It says, "And David rose and fled that day from Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath." So that doesn't sound too bad, but when we read Psalm 56, the introduction says that David was captured by the Philistines. It reads, "To the choir master, according to the dove on far-off terebinths, a miktam of David, when the Philistines seized him in Gath." So maybe David was going to Gath to kill Achish, trying to regain Saul's favor, maybe? I don't know. I mean, the Philistines are Israel's biggest threat, for sure. So that could have been the case. Or maybe David fled there to hide from Saul. We're really not told, but some Philistines must have found him and took him to Achish because, well, he is David, and he's somewhere he should not be. Verse 11 says, "And the servants of Achish said to him, 'Is not this David, the king of the land? Did they not sing to one another of him in dances? Saul has struck down his thousands and David his 10,000s. So they know David's song. They know who he is. And chapter 21 goes on to tell us that when David realized that, it made him very nervous. Like he all of a sudden understands this trip to Gath was not a good idea. And he needs to figure out a way that he can get back home. And so he starts acting like a crazy person. Verse 13 says, "He changed his behavior before them and pretended to be insane in their hands and made marks on the doors of the gate and let his spittle," that's a great word, "spittle run down his beard. Then Achish said to his servants, 'Behold, you see the man is mad. Why then have you brought him to me?'" Now verse 15 is gold. Do I lack madmen that you have brought this fellow to behave as a madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house?" I think that's so funny what Achish says. It's like, guys, take crazy somewhere else. We're all full here, you know? But thankfully, David's plan worked. It really worked. And so he goes back to Judah to a city called Adullam. I know I'm moving kind of fast, but I'm trying to get somewhere. Adullam sits on top of a ridge overlooking the Elah Valley, which we know is a place of happier memories for David, because the last time he was in that valley, he was on top of the world. He had just killed Goliath. Everyone loved him and was praising him. Now, Adullam is really a great choice for David to go to because it has this network of caves up along the ridgeline, and David ended up taking shelter there in those caves. They're great places to hide. It was a good strategic location on high ground. He could see anyone that was approaching. And this is where a lot of folks think David wrote Psalm 57. Maybe Psalm 142 as well. Now the word Adullam means refuge. And these caves became a place of refuge for David, where he could think and he could sleep and he could kind of orient his mind back to his God, and he could stop running for a while. So this place of refuge, it really helped David to reconnect to his true refuge. Psalm 57 begins this way. "Be merciful to me, O God. Be merciful to me, for in you my soul takes refuge. In the shadow of your wings I will take refuge, till the storms of destruction pass by. I cry out to God Most High, to God who fulfills His purpose for me. He will send from heaven and save me. He will put to shame him who tramples on me. God will send out his steadfast love and his faithfulness. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. And God does just that, y'all. In chapter 22 of 1 Samuel, it opens with this. David departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him. And everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, everyone who was bitter in soul gathered to him. And he became commander over them. And there were with him about 400 men. You know, this is such a Jesus thing to do. David's relationship with his brothers wasn't the best, right? But when David reaches his lowest, and this is the lowest point in David's life so far, his family shows up for him. They come to him at Adullam. Now, whether their motivation for doing that was guilt or love or whatever it was, we're not really told. But I don't think it mattered to David. They were there now. He was not alone anymore. He had his family with him. And not only that, look at verse 2. It says, and everyone who was in distress, and everyone who was in debt, love that, and everyone who was bitter in soul gathered to him, and he became commander over them. So the folks that nobody wanted to be around go to David. Probably not people he would have chosen, given the option. These were folks in distress like he was. Their lives were hard. Their lives were frustrating. It says some of them were in debt, maybe from bad choices or bad investments, or maybe due to the really harsh taxation that Saul had placed on everybody. And some of them, the writer tells us, were bitter in soul. They weren't satisfied with their lives as they were. Maybe they had a lot of regrets over things they'd done in the past. Maybe they look back on their lives and they see themselves as failures. Whatever their circumstances were, God assembled this group and called them to David at the caves. And he becomes their leader. This was a motley crew, y'all. This was a bunch of fed up and restless malcontents. These are legacy people. These are our people. These are the types of people Jesus was drawn to. These are the people that nobody else wanted. And unfortunately, these are the kind of people that so many of our modern churches ignore and they turn away. Because we want the pretty church. We want the shiny church. We want the church that looks the way we think it should look, which is rarely the way Jesus wants it to look. Here at Legacy, and Dennis and I have said this from the beginning, bring them all. Bring them all. We'll take the ones nobody else wants. We actually kind of prefer it that way, don't we, Pastor? Because when Jesus takes old and young and black and white and poor and rich, he takes red voters and blue voters, folks who will not associate together in any other realm of life. When Jesus takes that hot mess and he makes it a worshiping and a serving and a sending church, then all the glory is his. It's not ours. It's his. His power and his grace are on full display for everybody to see who's paying attention. And that's what we want here. Because that's what heaven is going to look like, right? That's what heaven is going to look like, and that's what we want here at Legacy. So when I contemplated verse 2, I got really happy. I got really happy. And something else I noticed is, you know, David may not have called these people to himself like Jesus called his followers, but he took them in like Jesus did. He loved them and he taught them like Jesus did. He took people who were broke and broken and he prepared them for his coming kingdom, just like Jesus did. And y'all, these 400 roughnecks that David's got with him now, these are the guys that would become David's mighty men of valor. the guys that 1 Chronicles 12:8 describes as mighty and experienced warriors, expert with shield and spear, whose faces were like the faces of lions and who were swift as gazelles upon the mountains. David did that. You know, a lesser man, a man not after God's own heart, he could have turned these men into a mob. Some ruthless, bloodthirsty rebel army who he could use to terrorize everybody. He could use them to kill Saul and take the throne if he wanted to. But David doesn't do that, because David fears the Lord. David wants to serve his God. And so he refuses to raise his sword against God's anointed. Saul may be a crazy man, but he's still the anointed king of Israel. And David will not raise his sword against him. And if he's around, he will not allow anyone else to raise their sword against him, because he fears the Lord. Plus, David's first priority seems to be his parents' safety. Verses 3 and 4 tell us that he took his mom and his dad and he went to Moab. And he asked the king of Moab if they could stay with him until David kind of figures things out. Now, why do y'all think he chose Moab? That's a strange pick. And I was wondering if his great-grandmother had anything to do with that. Y'all remember who David's great-grandmother was? It was Ruth, the Moabitess. She was the wife of Boaz. She was the mother of Obed, the same Obed who fathered Jesse, who fathered David. And honestly, I don't know if that connection had anything to do with David's decision. I thought it was kind of peculiar. And plus, I've also come to learn that there's not a lot of coincidences in here. You know, at first glance, there may seem like they are, but there's not many. Most of this stuff is very intentional. Now, remember earlier when we read verse 7 of chapter 21? I said it'd be important later. Well, here it comes. Verse 6, now Saul heard that David was discovered and the men who were with him. Saul was sitting at Gibeah under the tamarisk tree on the height with his spear in his hand. There's that spear again. And all his servants were standing about him. And Saul said to his servants who stood about him, "Hear now, people of Benjamin, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards? Will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds? That all of you have conspired against me. No one discloses to me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. None of you is sorry for me or discloses to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as at this day." Then answered Doeg the Edomite, who stood by the servants of Saul, "I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob, to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub. And he inquired of the Lord for him and gave him provisions and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine." There's always one, isn't there? There's always one. And our paranoid king does what paranoid kings do. Look at verse 11. Then the king sent to summon Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house. The priests who were at Nob, and all of them came to the king. And Saul said, "Hear now, son of Ahitub." And he answered, "Here I am, my lord." And Saul said to him, "Why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, and that you've given him bread and a sword and have inquired of God for him so that he's risen against me to lie in wait as at this day?" Then Ahimelech answered the king, "And who among all your servants is so faithful as David? Who is the king's son-in-law and captain over your bodyguard and honored in your house? Is today the first time that I've inquired of God for him? No. Let not the king impute anything to his servant or to all the house of my father, for your servant has known nothing of all this, much or little." You've got to give Ahimelech credit. He is not backing down. This is a true man of God, a true believer, and he chooses that dangerous truth over convenient lies. He could have wormed his way out of this probably, but he doesn't even try to do that. He speaks truth to King Saul. And verse 16 says, "And the king said, 'You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house.' And the king said to the guard who stood about him, 'Turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because their hand also is with David, and they knew that he fled and did not disclose it to me.' But the servants of the king would not put out their hand to strike the priests of the Lord. Then the king said to Doeg, 'You turn and strike the priests.' And Doeg the Edomite turned and struck down the priests. And he killed on that day 85 persons who wore the linen ephod." Those were the priests. "And Nob, the city of the priests, he put to the sword, both man and woman, child and infant, ox, donkey, and sheep he put to the sword." And y'all, David, he finds out what happens, and he does what anyone would do. He blames himself. He blames himself. And of course, we know that he's not responsible for Doeg's actions, but he feels like he is. He probably thinks that, you know, if he hadn't have gone there in the first place, that none of this would have happened. Now, he's probably right. It wouldn't have. But David can't predict and David can't control other people's responses to what he says and does. No more so than any of us in this room can. But his heart's broken. And moving forward, he will learn from this and he will not put himself in a position like that again. And we're going to see that next week. That's going to be pretty interesting to see. So let me pray for us. God, thank you again for allowing us to be here and for learning about your servant David, how he's so much like us, God. He's just someone trying to do the best.